Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is Toby Miller, who was recently a Professor of Cultural Industries at the City University of London, and prior to that, the Director of the UC Studies Center in Mexico City and Chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Toby Miller is one of the world's leading analysts on popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. His books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television, and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blowing Up the Humanities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And the Academy Awards nominations have just been announced, and you're there in London, and I'm sorry that to pry you away from the pub, but I wanted to get a perspective of somebody that's outside of the country, because in many ways, the American movies or Hollywood movies are one of America's most powerful exports, and in terms of what they call soft power, the influence of Hollywood is immense. And many people, for example, attribute the end of the Cold War to rock and roll and movies, not how many nuclear missiles the Russians and the Americans had pointed at each other. So with that in mind, do you see a change in the culture, if you will, of the Motion Picture Academy and its members?
Well, Ian, you raised so many good points in your question. Going back to the soft power issue, I've always thought this was a slightly embarrassing, rather penile metaphor. But Joe Nye, NYE, who was, of course, a Clinton official in Bill Clinton's presidency and is a noted international relations academic whose work you know well, was the person who coined this expression to say that the obvious power that comes from commercial and military authority and advantage is sometimes buttressed and, in fact, sometimes almost insignificant next to the power of what's sometimes called public diplomacy, or what the United States likes to imagine is person-to-person interaction, where a citizen of one country engages a citizen of another, regardless of the power of the state or anybody else. But, of course, the U.S. always wants this to be done in a way that suits its international agenda of both its military and its commercial wings. Well, in the case of Hollywood, really, although nowadays there's a lot of talk about the importance of this international market, the international market, which means outside the U.S. and Canada, Canada is regarded rather patronizingly as domestic for the purposes of Hollywood revenues, the international market's been absolutely crucial for over 60 years, and it becomes more and more so with the Internet and the requirement to release things almost on the day that they become available in the United States all over the world. When it comes to the Academy itself and what it decides to nominate, there are, in terms of English language movies, there are really only a couple of possibilities for what wins each year as Best Picture. It still tends to be a raft of movies, mostly not action adventure, mostly not comedies, made by the Hollywood studios that are the preferred nominees, and then there'll generally be one movie maybe made in Britain that is the alternative. And so, you know, the big kind of hit pick as a possible alternative this year is 12 Years a Slave, which is a black British film about the appalling history of the black Atlantic slave trade. But whether the Academy itself is really changing, that's a question we get asked on a regular basis. It's still dominated by the people who dominate the running of Hollywood itself, both in the studios and across the guilds.
Well, one of the things, though, about the Academy Awards ceremony itself is that it's often a sort of accidental venue, if you will, for political outbursts, more often than not from the left. And, you know, sometimes one waits through these interminable ceremonies on television in the hope that somebody's going to say something either real, relevant, or incendiary.
Well, this probably goes back most memorably to The Godfather, the first Godfather picture, when Marlon Brando refused to appear to accept the Academy Award as Best Actor. And a Native American woman agreed to speak for him and to speak about the oppression of indigenous peoples by U.S. domestic imperialism. And, of course, since then, we've had a number of other interventions. Sometimes they're regarded as fairly benign. So, for instance, around the late 80s and early 90s, there was lots of discussion of the need for public policy movement in the treatment of HIV and AIDS, and people wore ribbons about it and spoke about it in speeches at the Oscars. That wasn't terribly controversial. But when you had Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins speaking out about the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, when you had Michael Moore speaking out against the George W. Bush administration, then there were some very negative responses. Years ago, back in the 70s again, when Vanessa Redgrave spoke out about the plight of the Palestinian people, some very negative responses. So there can be these enlivening moments, these extraordinary moments, as with the Palestinian protest, as with the Native American one. And there can also be a sense of just liberal Hollywood patting itself on the back, which you got a bit, I think, with HIV and AIDS. But whether there'll be any kind of protest remark this time remains to be seen. I'm not quite sure what topic it might take. Liberal Hollywood is always very proud of its environmental record. It'd be nice to see some people making a protest about the environmental despoliation involved in the motion picture and television industries, which is appalling, and in the Southern California area is responsible for, it's said by some experts, greater pollution than any other industry, including aerospace and the car industries. But I doubt that will happen, frankly. I don't think we quite have the cause, and I don't think we have the preparedness to tie things into criticizing the industry itself. What we might also hope to see, of course, is some critique of how the Academy goes about its voting, which remains quite arcane. At times has seen bodies like the Internal Revenue Service get involved because it seemed to be, if not corrupt, I don't think that would be a fair word to use, then at least something where favors are encouraged as a consequence of gifts. And the IRS has wanted to see that counted against people's income for tax purposes. I don't see any major reform of how the Academy goes about its business. It remains a day of self-congratulation, reaching out to the globe and to the United States in particular and saying, aren't we wonderful?
Well, of course, if the IRS is looking for favors and swag and gifts right. and payback and payola or plugola, they don't have to go further than the Golden Globes or even worse, the People's Choice Awards on CBS, which, interestingly enough, everybody that wins happens to be the only person that's in the room.
Well,
coincidence.
With the Golden Globes, they've been the butt of many jokes over the years, and there are some very serious people who are members of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the entity that votes for the Golden Globes, but certainly they are not perhaps regarded as having the same stature as the Oscars. And of course, in many cases, the Oscars, most of them are for very technical skills, and they're voted for by people who are real masters of their craft and art, and they're taken very seriously. And I don't wish to suggest for a moment that they're simply bored, but it is true that there was a period in the 90s and the early noughties when magnificent hampers full of champers and clothes and jewels and who knows what would appear at people's houses along with DVDs of the movies that the studios were promoting in the hope that they would get nominated or voted for. And I think that's what alerted the IRS to this boondoggle, this problem. But I think there's a wider issue here, which, to get back to your question about soft power and hard power, which is the extent to which Hollywood matters around the world and why it matters. People like you and me, Ian, are probably prone to saying this is about the way in which the United States government and commerce operates effectively to control the distribution of motion picture and television drama entertainment. But for most critics, and for most folks perhaps, it's all about, well, they've got the best pictures, or they've got the best stories, or they spend the most money, so it's the most entertaining. And that's all that Hollywood means. It's just entertainment and fun. And one of the tasks for those of us who think that something more is being sold than simply 2 hours of entertainment is to show why the 2 hours of entertainment has the effect that it has in terms of people's views of questions of gender and race and class and imperialism, but also to show that some of the reason for Hollywood's success is not just the quality and the capacity of its artists, quality and capacity that I don't doubt, but much more to do with the very hard power of U.S. militarism and commercial authority buttressing the export and import of Hollywood product.
And again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, who's in London. He was recently the Professor of Cultural Industries at the City University of London, and prior to that, the Director of the UC Studies Center in Mexico City and Chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Toby Miller is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. And in terms of, you mentioned how the movie industry is detrimental to the environment here in Southern California. Explain that.
Well, think about in terms of production, and there may be listeners who were intimately involved in the production of Hollywood cinema and television, the amount of carbon footprint that we generate when we drive trucks or cars to venues. Think about the amount of electricity, much of it powered by carbon, that we utilize, we draw upon at every point from pre-production through production and post-production. As consumers, think about the amount of electricity that we use when we turn on our televisions or our computers, or the amount of carbon footprint that we generate when we drive to the movie theater. Think about the waste of packaging and so on that is part of everything from tickets through to popcorn holders. Put all that together and you have a quite remarkable impact on our environment. Now, to be fair, most of the major movie studios and many of the film commissions around the world that facilitate Hollywood have green production guides, and everyone from Time Warner through to Sony talk a good game about trying to green Hollywood. But the fact is that all the devices that you and I are talking through, that people are listening through now, are themselves the product of, frankly, very ecologically unsustainable practices, all the way from mining the various minerals that go into these products through to how they are powered, how we receive and transmit information across them, and so on. So it's one of these things where you have to think about the entire commodity sign, the commodity sign that is your favorite reality TV show or your favorite movie, and say, what actually went into, in terms of natural resources and unnatural resources, the making of that, the transmission of that, the reception of that? What part did I play as an audience member? What part did you play as a producer?
Well, while our audience is trying to absorb their personal responsibility for the planet here, let's go back to the handicapping here of Hollywood with these nominations that just came out from the Academy. And just in terms of an earlier question about whether or not the voting pool, the Academy members are exhibiting some change. It's notable that both Robert Redford and Tom Hanks, who, of course, have, you know, long-standing Hollywood credits, did not get Oscar nominations for their performances, where a group of younger actors certainly did. And, of course, the actor in the 12 Years a Slave also is in that group. So what do you make of that? Is that some kind of indication of a cultural shift?
Well, it is remarkable that Tom Hanks wasn't nominated because he has been very successful as a lead actor in the past and, of course, has won Best Actor a couple of times. It's also remarkable that Robert Redford wasn't nominated because it is a remarkable and extraordinary performance. I wouldn't say that it's all about going for youth, because dear old Bruce Dern got the nod for Nebraska. He makes you and me look like spring chickens, Ian.
By the way, did that film, I saw it. It's in black and white. I found that to be intensely political, because I always, mm-hmm. That's my kind of cross to bear, if you will. I tend to be interested in political aspects of things. And, of course, there's the old saying, art ends where politics begins. But I thought that film was really an indictment of, red state America. It's almost as if red state America is a dead zone in that movie. It was quite disturbing.
No, I think that's absolutely true. And you think back to the Bruce Springsteen record of maybe 15 years ago in Nebraska, where there's a love for that area, but also a sense of intense desolation and hopelessness. Think of the music, too, of John Cougar Mellencamp talking about life in the upper Midwest, the Midwest in general, and what that can mean. But I think you're right. In terms of the, you know, the sort of changes, I suppose that for me, we'll know there's been some kind of shift, at least an attitudinal one, if 12 Years a Slave is extremely successful, particularly if it wins Best Picture, because it is excoriating, relentless, remorseless in its pursuit of some profound truths about the slave trade and about the mistreatment of Africans by it. And I think that, you know, if we see that winning for Steve McQueen as director, if we see that winning Best Picture, then part of that will be about the idea that, well, if it's vaguely British, then we're allowed to vote for it. But part of it will also be trying to confront the question of racism at the core of American life. And to me, that will be the most exciting element. If American Hustle wins everything, or The Wolf of Wall Street, to me, that's just one more year in the Oscars, and no one will remember it 5 minutes later.
Well, in terms of slavery, though, I mean, it's in the DNA of our politics. I mean, it's still in the South, in the sense not it's not practiced anymore, but it still shapes the politics. The Republican Party is a Southern party. It's a Confederate party, if you will. We have a kind of new feudalism in the South, and Wall Street and American capitalism is moving to the South. That is their preferred model, as opposed to the North, the Union, where people belong to unions. In the South, they're right-to-work states. So I think the legacy of slavery is not just historical. It's cultural and it's political, and more importantly, it's economic.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. And this goes back to two key events in U.S. history. One is a century after the end of the Civil War, when Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the major civil rights legislation in 64-65 that changed so much of the landscape of the country, and famously said, well, I'm signing away a Democratic majority for decades. And the other major event just a few years later is Richard Milhouse Nixon in 1968 in the presidential election campaign adopting what was called the Southern Strategy. And this was picking up on exactly what Johnson had realized, namely that the Dixiecrats, the far-right racist white men who formed the majority for the Democratic Party in the South over really a century, were being alienated and sent off to the Republican Party by the decision as a consequence of human rights campaigns, social movements, and a lot of white men, frankly, changing their minds in favor of civil rights for African Americans and full citizenship for African Americans. And the Southern Strategy that Nixon adopted in 68 is really what won him that election, and it's what won him re-election in 72, and it's what won Reagan his elections. Namely, we will seek to win over the white working class in sufficient numbers, along with people who directly benefit from the oppression of African Americans and other working class people of color, by telling them that it is cultural matters and civil rights questions that have held back their own advancement and their success, and they should resent those who receive either forms of direct economic welfare or who receive opportunities hitherto denied them by the system as a consequence of legislation and public policy. And that has continued to be at the core of the Republican Party's mission. There is absolutely no doubt about that. And of course, tied to that is also massive investment by the Pentagon in key southern states where there is very little private investment often that is not tied to Pentagon military expenditure, and hence a whole set of local Congress people whose re-election is tied again and again and again and again to being able to bring home the bacon from the Pentagon and provide so-called private sector jobs, as I say, that are in fact part of corporate welfare. So, you know, that system remains extremely strong. The Southern Strategy that Nixon enunciated is really the only strategy the Republican Party has.
Well, just in closing, Toby Miller, in terms of the best pictures, you mentioned 12 Years a Slave, and we talked about Nebraska. The Dallas Buyers Club, of course, was a film about HIV/AIDS, which was a forbidden subject for a long time in Hollywood. But the one that looks like it might win, and has certainly got the most nominations, is American Hustle, and that's loosely about the Abscam scandal in the 70s in Washington, D.C. I think in many ways that film touched into the current zeitgeist about America's disgust with politicians and with Congress in particular.
I think you're right, and David O. Russell is a very, very competent filmmaker, and he has an excellent cast in American Hustle. And there's no doubt that Hollywood, you know, I've said some very critical things about it during this discussion, has always been prepared to, going back to the 30s and all the way through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, engage the question of corruption in D.C. and in political circles, also juridical circles, and corporate ones as well. And I think that, you know, this is something, as you say, that relates to the sense of alienation many of us feel in the United States. The key thing for the left, it seems to me, is to tap into the understandable anti-statism that is powerful across the U.S., but not accept it on its own terms, and instead try to tie it into seeing how anti-statism is, in fact, really, in most people's cases, about being poorly served by government. So we need motion pictures that don't say the state is irredeemable and evil, but instead give us, in addition to critiques, uplifting stories of where government can really make a difference in a democratic way.
Well, Toby Miller, I thank you so much for joining us here.
A pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who is in London. He was recently a professor of cultural industries at the City University of London, and prior to that, the director of the UC Studies Center in Mexico City and chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Toby Miller is one of the world's leading analysts on popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Captured the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, the United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about President Obama's plea to the Democratic senators not to sabotage the diplomatic breakthrough with Iran.